We are back. This is Daniel Estulin. You're listening to the Power Hour. Today we have an amazing guest, Mike Billington, from the Executive Intelligence Review LaRouche organization. Mike, welcome back.
Thank you.
I wanted to get your take or your read on what I said about Helga's comment at the 2019 conference of the Dialogue of Asian Civilizations before we move on.
Yes, Helga made that statement that you read, that beautiful statement at the beginning of her speech at this conference on the Dialogue of Asian Civilizations. She also attended the Silk Road Forum 2 years ago, and then this one she's seen Xi Jinping speak twice. And she made this comment about the urgency of people learning the cultures of the rest of the world. And she said today in a briefing, or yesterday in a briefing she was giving to a group of us here in the organization, that the idea of this clash of civilizations, which we're seeing now especially in this rabid attack on China, you even had a State Department official named Skinner, who said that China, as our FBI chief, Christopher Wray, said, China is the greatest threat to America. They're out to take over everything. And this woman, Skinner, actually said, this is the first time we've had to face a non-Caucasian enemy. I mean, think about that. What a racist statement that you'd hear from the British Empire. But this inspired Helga to reference the fact that this clash of civilizations idea, which came originally from Bernard Lewis, this despicable British intelligence operative in the academic world, who gave it to Samuel Huntington. You probably remember he wrote this book called Clash of Civilizations.
Back in 1983, that's right, yeah.
Exactly. And Helga said, you know, at the time I held my nose and read this book because everybody was talking about it. And what I came away with was the recognition that this man, Samuel Huntington, knew absolutely nothing about the cultures that he was attacking. He knew nothing about Confucianism. He knew nothing about Islam. He knew nothing about anything. He was a geopolitician hack writing this thing and using it to justify another aspect of America becoming a tool of the British Empire, carrying out British wars, as of course we did, starting with the killing of Kennedy, and going into this hideous war in Vietnam, and as we've done under Bush and Obama with these hideous wars in the Middle East against countries that are no threat to us, are anti-terror, and yet we're attacking them under the so-called war on terror, and that this was only stopped because Trump and Russia got together to stop it in Syria. And this, I think, people have to really grasp. There's only one reason that we succeeded in ending this terrorist scourge across the Middle East. It wasn't the Iraq War. That encouraged terrorism. It wasn't the Libya War. It encouraged terrorism. It's because the Russians and the Trump administration joined hands, even though officially they couldn't do it. So they called it deconfliction. You do your thing, we'll do our thing, but we'll be in touch all day, every day. And they succeeded in wiping out this ISIS scourge by not attacking the government, by not getting drawn into a regime change war, which is just another word for a colonial war. Now, this is exactly what we must be doing on every aspect of the world economy and the world strategic situation, collaborating on ending terrorism, collaborate on building nations in the tradition of Franklin Roosevelt, which is now being led by Xi Jinping and the Belt and Road process. Let me mention here, you probably have discussed this before in your show, Daniel, but the idea of the new Silk Road, what's called the Belt and Road in China, came directly from Lyndon and Helga LaRouche. When the Soviet Union collapsed in the early 90s, Lynn and Helga immediately said, okay, this is the time to end not only the Cold War, but to end geopolitics forever by building the new Silk Road, connecting Europe with Asia, an idea that was launched by Gottfried Leibniz back in the 1700s when he said he was in collaboration with the Jesuit missionaries in China and was publicizing this great Confucian philosophy in Europe. And he said these two great cultures on either end of the Eurasian continent reaching out to each other will bring the rest of the world up with them. And it's precisely that idea of the New Silk Road, embracing all of mankind in the idea of connectivity, not just physical connectivity through development corridors and rail lines, but through the connectivity of cultures, bringing people to understand and grasp other cultures in the context of seeing that these, all of these cultures had great moments and bad moments. Our culture had horrible moments of crusades and genocide in so-called Western Christian culture. But we had great moments of Renaissance, in which the idea of the human being in the image of God through his creative powers became the basis of society, in which you then generated great science, great culture, great music, great art. These are the kinds of things that come from a society orienting itself towards the higher sense of the meaning of being a human being, focusing on the creative power of man as that which makes us man and which makes us being one race, a human race. And we are now very, very close, closer than we've been since at least the death of Roosevelt, but actually even further back than that, close to achieving a transformation of the world, a new paradigm for mankind, based upon sovereign republics, but sovereign republics which embrace the interests of the other by bringing these great cultures together. And in that way, having a Renaissance, which is not a Western Renaissance or an Islamic Renaissance or a Confucian Renaissance, but a truly human Renaissance in which we collaborate in going to space, in developing new scientific and technological capacities, on generating new great music, on fostering the idea that every single nation on earth, every poor African, South American, Asian nation has the right and the capacity, as China has demonstrated, to break out of poverty, to break out of backwardness, and to actually become a modern scientific industrial nation with an educated population aspiring to greatness as a nation and as a human race. So this is where we stand. This is the legacy of the LaRouche movement, and it's one we'll be celebrating. You probably have mentioned this to your listeners. On June 8th, we are holding a memorial in New York City for Lyndon LaRouche, after his death on February 12th, which will bring together these voices from around the world to declare the beauty and the brilliance of this mind, which has created the environment in which we have this potential today to achieve this new paradigm for mankind.
But summarize what you said, Mike, the means to defeat the evil we face. So today is to mobilize the American people. That'll be the first step. And also the people around the world, and to induce President Trump to carry out his pledge to enact the Glass-Steagall Act, something that LaRouche has been working on and promoting for a very, very long time. And also restore the American system of Hamiltonian banking, capable of directing credit, international infrastructure, industrial and agricultural growth, which right now doesn't exist, and also restoring the nation's dedication to advancing the frontiers of scientific knowledge through fusion power development and also space exploration, because Trump has said and has demonstrated that he's willing to work with the great nations of the world, Russia, China, Japan, and also restored Europe and America to create an era of peace through development, as with Xi Jinping's win-win policy, the New Silk Road. And by restoring America's role as a nation builder and protecting the future of not only American children, but everyone's, our children, as productive and creative human beings instead of some degenerate animals, which we're seeing today, America, Russia, China, India, and the rest of the world can and must once again stand as the temple of hope and beacon of liberty for the entire world, because it has always been this way. We've always looked up to America. You know, I, as a Russian, you know, we are not America's enemies. And that's what I've been trying to explain to people for a long time. We are on the same side. We helped you in the Civil War, and you helped us in the Revolution. We are working on the same side against the same interests. Let's change the subject. There's no one in the history of the United States for whom there's a greater discrepancy between the image crafted by the neoliberal establishment and the so-called mainstream media through decades of slanders and covert operations of all kinds and the actual reality of the person himself. And, of course, I'm referring to Lyndon LaRouche. If you read Wikipedia and what they say about him, it's very little to do with reality of who and what LaRouche is. For me, one of the greatest statesmen in the last 50 years, bar none in the entire world. And that is saying a lot in the wake of the more than two-year witch hunt against President Donald Trump. Now, my question is, why do you think that exoneration of LaRouche is synonymous with the fate of the United States?
The reason that Trump himself and Trump's supporters have been unable to carry out these things that he's committed to is that there is not a base in the American people or in the leadership layers who were able to do in any way help him do that. So he's surrounded by neoconservatives on the strategic side, where when he says, I want to pull out of Syria, they go crazy. He's surrounded by Wall Street, Goldman Sachs people who, when he says, I want to have good economic relations with China, they go crazy and sabotage his effort to have an agreement. All right. So the problem is that the American people, when they allowed the massive slanders and attacks against Lyndon LaRouche in the 1980s, and the imprisonment of LaRouche and myself and several of my associates, as you know, Dennis.
Yeah, back in 1989.
When we were all thrown in prison and the American people swallowed the lies of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and the Washington Post and the CNN and whatever TVs were active at that time, when they swallowed that, when they listened to these wild slanders, they degraded themselves. They allowed themselves to be dumbed down. I don't need to research why this person is such a threat to the establishment. They told me he's a bad person. They can't tell me why, but they told me he's a bad person, and I have to accept that because I'm an American. Therefore, I have to accept what the American media tells me. This is the psychology which allowed, think what happened since the 1980s. The takedown of our nuclear industry, the destruction of our rail infrastructure, the mass drugging up of the American people, and a drug epidemic that hasn't been seen since the opium wars against the Chinese, the destruction of our industrial infrastructure, the decay and collapse of our major cities like New York and so forth. We've won, and a cultural decline, which is just horrifying. Right? And so you have a dumbed down population, which is finally being somewhat woken up by the reality that everything LaRouche warned would happen if we didn't do these things, if we didn't restore Hamiltonian economics, if we didn't work with the rest of the world on great infrastructure. We warned that there would be a breakdown of the economy. People would lose their jobs. They'd see their children drugged up. You'd see their children being brainwashed with pornography and violence. And, of course, all of that has happened. So that's why Trump got elected, of course, because he was saying, this is the disaster we're in, and I'm going to change it. So he hasn't succeeded yet. He's done a few decent things. But as we've discussed, he's surrounded by people who sabotage his every move. Now, LaRouche was targeted at the point that he recruited Ronald Reagan to work with Russia on developing a space-based anti-missile technology, what we call beam defense, and which Ronald Reagan then called the Strategic Defense
Initiative,
which would, the SDI, which would end the era of thermonuclear terror once and for all. The British policy, which says we can blow them up, they can blow us up. It's called mutual assured destruction. That's good enough for us. That way we're not going to have a nuclear war. But, of course, Lynn LaRouche said, yeah, but that means we're forever divided. Why not work together on a system that can prevent nuclear attacks and, in the process, push forward on the human knowledge, at the frontiers of human knowledge, together with the great scientific community in Russia and other nations to bring about a new era free of this constant warfare, which, of course, was used by the British to justify colonial wars. surrogate wars against the Russians and the Chinese in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia and Africa and then in the Middle East. These are surrogate wars between these two blocks. Well, LaRouche said, let's get rid of these blocks. Let's actually bring about a new era of mankind free of war and Cold War based on scientific and technological progress and cooperation. So this is why he was targeted. And as I'm sure you know, he was targeted by a guy named Robert Miller. Robert Miller was appointed as the head of the Get LaRouche Task Force in the 1980s, who put Mr. LaRouche in prison, who put me in prison for 10 years, who ran a campaign for the same reasons that they're going after Trump, to prevent the U.S. and Russia and China from working together, to keep the world divided according to the British imperial divide of East and West. So that whole campaign, which was run against LaRouche, was run by exactly, literally, the same people who ran this despicable campaign against Trump. And those of you who watched Miller the other day get up and lie and lie and lie and say that the Russians interfered in our election, Trump committed obstruction of justice, go for the impeachment, go against the Russians because they're the ones that are out to destroy it. Well, I think you probably had a chance to talk with Bill Binney, the good friend of ours who we've been working with.
I haven't, but I'd love to have him on my show.
Oh, well, you should. Yeah, try to get him on. I mean, Binney was the person at the NSA who devised these programs, which were then misused to spy on everybody in the world. And he quit the NSA and exposed this fact along with Edward Snowden. Right. And he now has proven that this story about the Russians hacking into the Democratic computers was a total fabrication, a lie, that those emails were done by a download from somebody inside the DNC who was angry that they were supporting Hillary Clinton against the other Democratic candidate, Sanders, and therefore exposed the fact that they were doing that against their own rules. And of course, you think about this Russiagate thing for a minute. What they're saying, the argument against Russia, is that Russia, supposedly hacking these emails, which were then released, interfered in our democracy. Now, keep in mind, those emails are true. So what they're saying is bringing the truth to the American people about the corruption within the Democratic Party is a disruption of our democracy. The truth disrupts democracy. We have to keep people stupid for democracy to work. Right? So this is a rather ironic situation. But, of course, the Russians didn't do it. And they've said so all along. Assange has said so all along. Now we have the capacity, because Trump has appointed this guy, William Barr, and Barr has appointed Durham, both hard-nosed people who have had fights with the FBI in the past, who are willing to expose the fact that the intelligence community in this country has been corrupted and perverted by the British, and they have said openly, we are going to go after the British and the Australians and the Ukraine operation in those who started this witch hunt against the United States, an attempted coup against the United States government, which failed so far. But when you think about the fact that Trump has said publicly that not only was this a coup attempt, but it was treason. And now remember, treason means you're doing this on behalf of a foreign power, right? So these corrupted FBI, Miller, Clapper, the whole crowd, were consciously acting on behalf of a foreign power, our true enemy, not Russia. Trump knows it wasn't Russia. It's the British. And their Five Eyes friends in Australia and some of the Ukraine crowd who was put in power by the Obama administration, neo-Nazis, who openly, proudly carry their swastikas, who then worked with the British to try to bring down Donald Trump, to stop him from bringing the United States and Russia and China together. So we have a
Mike,
great
I think
moment.
We have about 3 minutes left. I wanted to ask you very quickly about Ferdinand Marcos. Now, we're going back in time to the 1980s, ex-president of the Philippines. Now, if you read mainstream media, now he was a corrupt dictator who stole billions from his people, and as evidence, they show Imelda Marcos's 3,000 pairs of shoes. But when Marcos was elected president back in 65, the Philippines still had a colonial economy. He moved to establish food self-sufficiency, which brought him into conflict with the landed aristocracy, the leftovers from from the Spanish imperial era. And he was the first president of the Philippines who did not rise from the elite class, but was a commoner trained as a lawyer. So why was Marcos the target of the economic hitman, and how does it fit into the bigger current worldview? We got about 2 minutes.
Okay, well, it's a long story, of course, but it's very important. Marcos is everything you just said. I've exposed this in my writings with the EIR. And in fact, I am in the process of completing a long article called Operation Marcos, where I'm proposing that because Duterte has come in, he was elected by people who were as furious as the Americans who voted in Donald Trump. And Duterte told Obama to go to hell. He's not going to go to war with China. When Trump came in, he embraced Trump and China. And we have the potential of bringing back the great development project which Marcos launched in the Philippines. The first nuclear power plant in Southeast Asia, 11 big industrial development programs, food self-sufficiency. That's why he was hated by the rising neoconservative movement. George Shultz, Paul Wolfowitz, who ran the first real color revolution, or perhaps the second after Iran, where they made the people think they were overthrowing a dictator, and in fact, they were putting a foreign power in charge through the banking system, which just absolutely destroyed the Philippines, turned it into the sick man of Europe when it was on the verge of becoming the idol of all the all the Asian countries. So the shoes, I'll just quickly close with the shoes. You know why she had all those shoes, Imelda? Because
no.
She founded a shoe industry in the Philippines.
Oh, she did.
She brought in Italian shoemakers. She brought in beef from Australia and started a cattle industry so they'd have leather. And they started an industry that did not exist. They had to import all their shoes. And she built this shoe industry into a great shoe industry. And the shoemakers, every time they designed a new pair of shoes, would send her a pair. This was a museum of her having successfully built a great industry in the Philippines. And this was then used to say, oh, she's a rich, profligate, corrupt, this and that. This was the first case of the American people being lied to in such a massive way that we ended up killing ourselves because we actually ended up destroying the Philippines. Now it's an example of why the U.S. and China
Mike, we're out of time. I hear the music. We're out of time. We had Mike Billington, Executive Intelligence Review. Wonderful interview, Mike. Thank you so much for being on the show. Take care.
Thanks for being on. Bye.
Bye-bye. We will be back. Stay tuned.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Foods, Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Oxygen. It's nature's oldest therapy and plays an essential role in destroying viruses, bacteria, mold, yeast, and fungus, and keeping the human body healthy and strong. Now, you can give your body and your immune system a mega boost of disease-fighting oxygen with all-natural Oxy-C. With so many people now leading a sedentary indoor lifestyle, most are in a chronic state of oxygen deprivation, which sets up a perfect environment for disease, general fatigue, and a host of other symptoms. Oxy-C is yours in simple, convenient capsules. Nothing to mix, nothing to hassle with. Take it with juice or water anytime. Feel a cold or flu approaching? Have no energy or spark anymore? Try all-natural Oxy-C and prepare to be amazed. Oxy-C is only available from New Earth Health Solutions at Rents.com. Look for the New Earth banner at Rents.com.
With dozens of food storage companies buying up airtime all over radio, it's hard for you to know which company you can actually trust. Numana Food Storage is nutritious, is GMO-free, contains no aspartame, no high fructose corn syrup, has no chemicals, preservatives, or soy. And Numana Food Storage has a 25-year shelf life. Call Jay at 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or order online at thepowermall.com.
America made just for you. Food storage I love to eat. Yum!
If you've been listening to this program for any length of time, you'll know that Fukushima, the greatest calamity in history, has now, as I've been warning since 3/11, killed off virtually the whole North Pacific Ocean and especially up and down the entire West Coast. The radiation is migrating inland and is moving across the entire country. There's only one proven defender to radiation exposure, the brilliant Chernobyl-proven discovery of Dr. Michael Kiriak, which combines the four most potent and powerful algaes on the planet, imported to the U.S. and known as Bio's Superfood. I've taken Bio's Superfood every day for several years now and want you to do the same for your sake and the health and safety of your family and loved ones. Take the banner at the top of Rents.com and prepare to learn how to save your life.
Hi, it's Catherine from the Power Hour. If you're one of the many millions of people who have difficulty falling asleep, staying asleep, or having unrestful sleep throughout the night, REM sleep could be the solution you've been searching for. If you are like me and are afraid of the dangerous side effects from prescription sleep aids, REM sleep is an all-natural alternative that contains ingredients research has shown to help improve and enhance better sleep. REM Sleep will get you the deep sleep you need to feel your best and will ensure you wake up feeling energized. To order, call 877-817-9829 or visit thepowermall.com today.
Does Big Pharma have a hold of you? Thepowermall.com believes everything the body needs is provided by nature, unlike prescription drugs that aren't meant to cure but cover up your symptoms and contain addicting chemicals. Strauss Heart Drops are 100% all natural. Get the original. Get Strauss Heart Drops by calling Jay at 1-877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or order online at thepowermall.com today.
We're back for the second hour, and we have about 25 minutes left before the end of the show. This is Daniel Estrell, and you're listening to the Power Hour broadcast. I'm the author of my latest book, called The In the Shadows of the Presidency. It deals with Donald Trump and his presidency. Today's guest, our second guest, is a gentleman by the name of Lowell Ponte. He's the former Reader's Digest roving editor. He's a political commentator and also the author and co-author of 8 different books. He's a co-author of one very, very interesting title which came out back in 2016 called Money, Morality, and the Machine. Lowell, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Daniel.
I wanted to start, because we don't have a lot of time, I want to jump right into this. I've been watching a lot of your interviews over the past couple of days, fascinating stuff. So I wanted to ask you about education in America. It's one of the topics to discuss today. Education in America, dumbing down of society. How far back did it go, and when did we start with this?
Well, certainly what we're seeing today is progressive education, which is dedicated to teaching children not how to think, but what to think. It is a form of propaganda. And in the progressive ideal, starting about 200 years ago, progressivism was dedicated to the idea that we want to do away with the old religion. We want to replace it with socialism or something like it, a society run by a small elite of people who are smarter than we are, a priesthood of scientists, and a god, not the God of the Bible, but the God of government. And in that, government is going to provide a new heaven on earth. It is going to provide a new Eden in which all will be cared for and will all be equal. Of course, to make that work, as we've seen particularly with the younger generation now, it's best that people remain children all their lives. They remain infantilized. They remain dependent. They start out dependent on their parents, for food, for housing, for income, whatever, and they simply switch that dependence to government at a certain age, and therefore they vote very loyally for one political party. We've seen the transformation in the U.S. of a system where we were very prosperous when we had two political parties, both of which were essentially centrist, capitalist, rationalist, able to reach compromises. Now we have one political party that's nominally capitalist and one political party that's anti-capitalist or outright socialist. And that means that every election is now, and every act of education in government schools, for that matter, is a kind of Russian roulette. And if the wrong party wins, which is to say the large government party, remember, the bigger government gets, the smaller individuals get, and vice versa. So when you encourage a society in which individuals mean nothing and the collective, the group, the government means everything, you're educating people simply to obey, to believe what they're told to believe. Ironically, in the name of science, they teach children to accept dogma. So you are simply supposed to believe in global warming because there is a quote-unquote scientific consensus. Of course, people like Al Gore will never debate that consensus. I mean, the head of atmospheric sciences at MIT has told Al Gore, "You're wrong about global warming. Would you like to debate me?" And Al Gore, of course, runs and says, "No, you simply have to believe because you've been told to believe." That's what the essence of progressivism is all about. It is an intensely conformist, anti-intellectual, anti-Western philosophy. And that's what
how
our education is dedicated to.
I'm sorry I interrupted you. How has education changed over the past 100 years? Because I come from a different country, from a different part of the world, and needless to say, our education system has changed in the past 25 years, but so has the American education system, and a lot. So how has America's education changed in the past 100 years, and what are some of these differences?
Well, first, may I ask, because I'm a curious person, what country is that?
I came from the Soviet Union.
Ah, well, my wife's father was born in the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. So we have a different education system.
Ты говоришь по-русски?
Я говорю по-русски, да, спасибо большое.
Okay,
a little bit of cultural integration for our audience.
Yes. And yet, it's important for people to understand, you now have an incredibly biblical name. The name Daniel, actually translated out of the Hebrew, means God is my judge.
Yeah, that's true.
In fact,
absolutely.
A lot of Western names are like that. Michael, names that end in A-L or E-L typically are references to God. So the name Michael means who is like God. Ezekiel means God strengthens. Samuel means ask of or heard of God, and so on.
Absolutely.
And you have a classically biblical name.
Well, thank you. So again, going back to what I said before, because again, like in our system, when I went to school, We can go back even, you know, to the middle 1950s. People who studied in Soviet universities, they had to read 350 pages per day every single day. In other words, you had about 126,000 pages of reading to do per year, and if you didn't read, you simply couldn't do the final exams. So you divide 126,000 to the days of the year, and you're about looking at a book per day. And that's what we're used to reading, and I do that still today because, again, I come from a different world. But you look at some of the numbers in America today, and not only America. You can talk about Canada, talk about Russia today, Western Europe. People read about a book a year at most, too, and some of them who go to university don't read anything at all. So there has been a great change in America's education system. So what are some of these changes?
Well, the single most damning thing about American education is most of it is done under government schools. It is done in socialist schools with unionized teachers. Their inclination is to favor big government and to disfavor small government capitalism and so on. But you're quite right. They have much more intense education in many other parts of the world, including the Soviet Union. Of course, the question then is, what exactly was the quality of what you were being asked to read? I know when Stalin was running the Soviet Union, for example, one thing that they suffered was the chief of sciences, that is, Stalin's science chief. If a scientist disagreed with him on some point of dogma, for example, in the Soviet Union, there was a scientist. I wasn't even prepared to think about this today. But he was one of the world's leading pioneers. His name was Nikolai Vavilov. And he's the man who has caused us to have seed banks all over the world. He was the one who realized that all foodstuffs in the world come from only about 10% of the world's land surface. That, for example, all coffee came originally from around Ethiopia and so on. All wheat came from around the Mediterranean, important. And he learned that if you're going to make hybrid grains to maintain food production in the world, you have to have access to the wild version of those seeds to keep recrossing them with domesticated versions. So he taught that. He believed that. He became a major pioneering scientist. And what did Stalin's science chief think? Oh, he disagreed with Vavilov. And so Vavilov was thrown in prison and died there of starvation.
He died of starvation in 43. It's a story, well-known story in the Soviet Union. The pronunciation is Vavilov. He was a Soviet agronomist and botanist and a geneticist. And yes, you're absolutely right. He identified the centers of origin of cultivated plants. And he did suffer 20 years imprisonment, and he died of starvation in prison in 1943. Yeah.
Yeah, so the reason I bring this up is because it is not well known in the West. It is not well known that the extent to which science was made to submit to dogma, and it's now being made in the United States to submit in many fields to the same kind of dogma. In fact, I was the roving science editor for Reader's Digest for 15 years, and I got to discover that any field of science I looked into, there was a group of government scientists who basically dominated the perspective in that scientific field. And they did so purely by access to government grants. They would decide who gets the National Science Foundation grant in a particular field, for example. And as such, their point of view would dominate, whether you're talking about iceberg utilization or climate or anything else. And that's a tragic loss of real science, which is to say science based on free inquiry and free thought. So that's one thing that's happened to our education. It has become much, it doesn't have the rigor of Soviet learning, but it does have the conformity of Soviet learning, I would guess.
Well, if you compare America 100 years ago, the education system, I was looking at some of the tests from way back when, beginning of the 20th century, 1905, and you compare it to the things that they're doing today, it's day and night. It's not even the same planet.
Oh, indeed. And from a writer's point of view, a few years ago in American television, there was a show called The Civil War on public television that quoted the letters that were being written by Civil War soldiers. And what was amazing is they were writing at a very high level of literacy and sophistication. Even though they were just ordinary people educated in one-room schoolhouses, they actually had learned writing, reading, and so on. Whereas today, you ask young people to write, generally you're going to have illiteracy or near illiteracy in writing. In fact, at one point in college, I was grading the papers to make, you know, money, pin money, from a local community college, and I was finding that everything being written by the young people was just bits and pieces from television commercials. That was their idea of a high use of the English language, was like half a phrase from an ad on TV. It was shocking. They did not come anywhere near the literacy that was common in ordinary Americans at the time of the Civil War.
Now, one of the things about reading skills, like for example, I read at a pace of about 800 words per minute. And a normal person reads, I think it's like 300 or something like that, or 250. You can read up to about 1,000. We were taught to read fast because, again, it's over, I'm 52 and been doing this all my life. But I noticed that, again, when you see how people read, they read and their lips move. That's one of the things that's shocking to me because, again, coming from a different culture. And also the fact that it takes them so long to actually move the eye across the page to understand what they're reading, not to mention the fact that the things that they're reading are not very complex. Now, I wanted to ask you something else. The College Board is introducing a new secret score identification, identifying students as either advantaged or disadvantaged, that will be used along with their SAT score to determine who gets admitted to college. Now, first of all, why are they doing this, and what is it all about?
I would guess they're doing it for a simple reason, that it involves a secret score, secret from the parents, secret from the students, that is based on things like what was the crime rate in the neighborhood of this student in his school, what was the average income of the neighborhood in which the child grew up, and so on. Right now, California and Florida have both banned colleges from using racial preferences as a standard in picking who will be admitted to a college and who won't. Many liberal universities are now scared to death that that's going to be imposed nationwide by the Supreme Court, because frankly, they want to be able to decide what the racial ethnic mixture of campuses is. They want to favor certain groups and disfavor others. And if, God forbid, we were to have a meritocracy, they could not do that. In fact, Harvard University is being sued right now by Asian Americans on grounds that they have systematically discriminated against Asian Americans who typically do much better on SAT tests and in college grade, in school grades and so on, than other ethnic groups. And as a result, if Harvard admitted people based purely on merit, on what they've actually achieved, Harvard would be more than half Asian in population. The University of California, Berkeley, would probably be 90% Asian. And so there has been this sudden concern to ban using direct racial standard as an input to who gets to go to college or not. The College Board has designed something to help these liberal universities, and that is a disadvantage test that basically, without ever mentioning the word race, sets a number of standards that lets them guess with high accuracy what the racial or ethnic background of a potential student is.
You know,
in other words,
it's really
a disadvantage what they expect the law to be. You'll notice that liberalism does a great deal to circumvent the law and the constitution here in the U.S.
You know, when I look at not only education system in America, but generation and humanity itself, each generation of humanity should be an improvement over the preceding generations in terms of power, in terms of understanding, and in terms of culture. Because then mankind has a sense of dynamic moving forward from generation to generation. But today people are part of a no-future society, and the question is, again, why? You're looking at the outcome-based education, which is a vicious suppression of creative powers of reason, these distinctly human mental capabilities expressed typically in the form of valid axiomatic revolutionary discoveries in physical science. Now, the proper purpose of education, I don't know if you agree with that, is not to prepare the young for some predetermined social status in adult life. The only moral purpose of education is to develop an entire population up to the level of scientific and moral knowledge necessary not only to perpetuate society at no less than its present level of power in the universe, but to carry the process of development of the whole population a step upward on a moral level. Well, how do you see, what is the purpose of education?
Oh, well, I certainly, you see, if you were talking from a liberal point of view in the liberal Western tradition, the tradition of the Enlightenment, we would agree that progress is measured linearly. It's not cyclic. It is going somewhere. It is an arrow. And therefore, people should learn what is new, what has been now recently discovered and so on by people. On the other hand, conservatives would say, we're perfectly content with that, but we want a portion, at least, of humankind to maintain all that we knew was good about the past, the values that actually helped people progress, live together, achieve peace and harmony, achieve progress, things like a work ethic and so on. In other words, you can't simply accept instantly every new discovery because some of those discoveries will actually prove to be wrong. And therefore, you don't want all of humankind. In other words, what you want is something like Noah's Ark. You want at least two of every different kind on the Ark. You want humankind protected the same way Vavilov might have said. Or how did you pronounce it? Vavilov?
Vavilov. Mm-hmm.
The way he would have wanted things protected by a certain amount of diversity genetically. You don't want everything pushed into a monoculture. And this is one of the difficulties with education, that it often forces everyone to accept ideas that haven't even been proven, like global warming. I mean, a whole lot of scientists will show you problems with global warming theory.
Right.
And as a result, people have to be skeptical, they have to be reasonable, they have to be thoughtful, but they have to be open to new ideas. And this is the challenge of education. This is why, as I said, good education teaches people how to think, how to be critical, how to be analytic, how to accept what is reasonable and good and new and opens new possibilities for humankind, but does not want us to sacrifice everything that was old and valued because of that. There needs to be some kind of balance struck. And all too often in liberal education, what you find today is the price of moving to something new is that the old must utterly be obliterated. You know, for example, we're going to have a line where either there is total government-supported abortion up to even after the ninth month, even after a child is born, he can be aborted, or women have no rights at all. Now, this is strange. You know, liberals say they want to be like Europe, and yet in Western Europe, virtually no country allows abortion as late as liberals here in the United States want it. All those liberal states that they think are just wonderful generally permit abortion up through the first trimester, but they would not allow abortion 5 months before or five minutes before natural birth. So in other words, education has to be a very diverse and interesting thing, and I think having many different kinds of education is a wonderful approach. I mean, there's enough scientific education right now to know that boys and girls should not necessarily be educated the same. That girls learn very well by sitting down, folding their hands, and reading a book. Boys tend to learn by doing things, by actually building a building or what have you. And so there is some room for saying education could be enhanced if we simply use whatever kind of education is most effective with whatever group of people we're dealing with. I don't know if you agree with that or not.
When you look at society today, which is a post-industrial society, one of the problems with the youth today is two questions that they cannot answer. One is, why am I alive? And question number two, in the name of what am I prepared to die? Which brings me to the next topic of immortality. And I kind of want to ask you about this. What does it mean to be mortal? Because if you die, what is the meaning of your life? And it is this perception, this understanding of oneself and what it is to be human, which defines a moral society, which is the willingness to die, if necessary, for one's nation in order to perpetuate these values for future generations of humanity and also to honor the previous generations, which have given us these gifts to share. And this is now these
years ago, I had a strange revelation, and that was that we are all martyrs. We talk about Christian martyrs, for example, but we are all martyrs. The only thing you get to choose, because you are going to die, is what you martyr yourself for. How many people do we know who have martyred themselves? They've traded their lives for a star on Hollywood Boulevard, or for
too
a
many.
House, or for a new car. They are every bit as much martyrs as those who die for God or other purposes, or die to protect their families. In fact, some would say that human evolution, if you look at it from, say, the point of view of a Hindu, their argument would be that when you are a baby, you act like a baby, you're totally selfish, everything is for you. As you become an adult, you become willing to die for your own family. If you are of the Kshatriya caste, you are willing to die for your entire nation. That is the caste of the warriors and the kings. If you are of the Brahmin caste, you are willing to die for God. So that is what orients your values. But what we're doing now is we've created a culture that makes people want to be babies. In fact, I found it interesting a few days ago in the magazine Slate, which is a left-wing webzine spun off from the Washington Post. One of their writers had an article called The Grandkid Strike, in which Christina Catarucci, argued that you should be willing to deny your parents having grandchildren. You should be willing to have a strike, not a sex strike like these Hollywood actresses advocate, but a sex strike that you will not reproduce grandchildren for your grandparents, for your parents, unless they begin conforming to your politics. And I thought, talk about cutting off your nose to spite your face.
Absolutely.
So you're saying you will not have children. There will be no one to care for you when you're old. There will be no one to fulfill the other side of that balance that we have learned to evolve in culture. That'll be very interesting. By the way, these are the kind of issues that Craig Smith, who you see every week on my co-author of 7 books, and he you see him every week on with Neil Cavuto on Fox Business. Our latest book, Money, Morality, and the Machine, we would be happy to give to everyone in your audience. This is our little mission from God. We're trying to enlighten people and show them how they're being tricked by the government and so on. And to get the book, I mean, we'll pay the postage and everything. This book will not cost you a penny. It's 250 pages. It reads like a novel. All you need to get it is to call 800, a toll-free number, 800-630-1492, like the year Columbus sailed the ocean blue. That's 800-630-1492.
Got it.
If you like this kind of conversation, I know you'll love this book.
You know, I think it all comes down to a moral problem, problem of mankind's destiny. Every generation must advance beyond that of the preceding generation. And that hope that will happen should be what's on the mind of the person who is dying of old age, that their life has meant something. As you said, not a star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame, but has meant something. Because it laid the foundation for a better life than they knew. And I think that's what immortality is all about. We're running out of time.
Well,
I think we have.
No, that's fine. That's certainly one issue, one way to look at it. Some people would say that you have moved forward by holding on to what was most valuable in the past and not letting it slip away. In other words, it's a matter of what you hold on to and what you let go of to achieve progress, as it's called. Progress is a very real thing, but it's also potentially a very elusive thing. I mean, the left now calls itself progressive. I don't view where they want to take humankind as a place of progress.
No, not at all.
It's a very negative place.
Yeah.
And so you can seem to be going forward, but you're going in the wrong direction. You're actually leading humankind backward. Basically, you're taking us back to serfdom and feudalism with socialism. You're taking us back to a society in which individual achievement, individual attainment has been snuffed out and replaced with a collectivist achievement. And I think that's a path to destruction in the long run for the human race.
Lowell, we're running out of time. The music is on. It was wonderful to have you on the show. I'm glad to have met you again. The number to call to get the book is 800-630-1493. Our guest today,
no,
Lowell Pontiff. 1492, I'm sorry, I meant to say 1492. 800-630-1492. Our guest today, Lowell Ponte. Thank you again so much for being on the show.
God bless you, Daniel.
Take care.
And the lover of my soul. Creator God, he is Yahweh. Great I am, he is Yahweh. The Lord of all, he is Yahweh. Possession of King Yahweh, righteous Son, he is Yahweh, the three in one, he is Yahweh.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Dr. Joe Schneller.
The efficacy that we're looking for, that we're going to prove, is that Carnivora wakes up this immune system and makes it dominate.
I highly recommend that you get started right away using Carnivora because it really will help you. Just follow the directions as the company gives them to you. And I just want everybody to know that there's been no one paid to do this. I'm doing this on my own because I care about everybody and want to see healthy people.
My husband has recovered tremendously after the physician suggested that he start taking Carnivora. When he was doing so well, I decided to start taking it as well, and we're both so pleased to be able to feel healthy again.
Hello, folks. Richard Ostro of Carnivora.